Hey, McNeil. U.S. President Trump is about to make a new push for overhauling the immigration system. AP correspondent Mike Rossi explains.
The Trump administration is set to propose changes to legal immigration policies. President Donald Trump will unveil a new immigration plan in a speech Thursday, making the argument to the American people that the current system needs to be overhauled. The overhaul proposal is being led by Trump's son-in-law and senior advisor, Jared Kushner. The plan would make changes to the current green card system, favoring people with high-level skills, degrees, and job offers over people with relatives already in the United States. The administration will also make a push for an asylum system overhaul designed to process fewer applications. Mike Gracia, Washington.
Iran has officially stopped some commitments under a 2015 nuclear deal with world powers following an order from its National Security Council. An official in the country's atomic energy body told the ISNA news agency. The Reuters' Lauren Anthony has more.
Under the deal, Tehran was allowed to produce a limited amount of low-enriched uranium, 300 kilograms, and produce what's called heavy water, which is used in nuclear reactors, again with a limit of 130 tons. They could also ship excess out of the country to store or sell. An official at Iran's atomic energy body says Iran will not stick to these limits from now on. In fact, they won't be enforcing limits at all. Last week, Iran told China, France, Germany, Russia, and the United Kingdom of its decision to stop these commitments, a year after the United States, an archenemy of Iran's, withdrew from the accord and reimposed sanctions.
That's Reuters' Lauren Anthony. The U.S. government said Wednesday that to date it has paid out more than $8.5 billion to American farmers to offset their losses of sales to China and other trading partners because of foreign tariffs imposed by Beijing and other governments. Signs that the cost seem to be mounting as a result of President Trump's trade war with China. This is VOA News. The Trump administration is pushing back on the action by the democratically controlled House Judiciary Committee, which continues to look into connections between the Donald Trump campaign and Russia during the 2016 election. VOA's White House correspondent Steve Herman.
The White House has sent a 12-page response to the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, accusing him of overreach and wanting to redo the special counsel's investigation into connections between the Donald Trump campaign and Russia during the 2016 election. The committee's chairman, Jerry Nadler, desires to hold a show trial for political theater, according to a White House senior official. The White House letter asks Nadler to narrow his request for documents, which the president's team contends are protected by executive privilege. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the White House.
Alabama Republican Governor Kay Ivey has signed into law a near-total ban on abortion, a measure now considered the nation's most stringent abortion law. It would make performing an abortion at any stage of pregnancy a felony punishable by up to 99 years or life in prison for the abortion provider. Although women seeking or undergoing an abortion would not be punished, the only exception would be when the woman's health is at risk. State senators rejected an attempt to add an exception for rape and incest. Legal analyst Eric Siegel says that this sets the stage for the highest court in the nation to get involved.
For decades now, most of the states in the South, like many other states in the country, most of which are red states, have been passing laws restricting abortion, making it more harder for women to get abortions. And all of that, I think, is geared towards getting a case up to the Supreme Court to reconsider Roe versus Wade.
The Planned Parenthood Federation of America vowed Wednesday to challenge the legislation in court. Houthi rebels are said to have moved their military forces away from the critical Red Sea port of Hodeidah, and a positive first step toward easing hostilities in the country's four-year-long civil war. The pullback is significant as Hodeidah's port has been a flashpoint in the conflict. It is the main point of entry for all commercial and aid supplies entering the country. Yemen imports 90% of all of its food. The United Nations plans to expand its monitoring and verification presence in Hodeidah. Currently, there are around 15 monitors, but it is said that 30 more are waiting on visa approvals from the Houthis, who are the de facto authorities in the Hodeidah. The world body hopes that the real progress there could be the confidence-building measure needed to get the parties back to negotiating to discuss a political transition and ultimately an end to the war. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, May 16th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Malawi's president dissolves his cabinet 5 days before the presidential election.
We have a section in the Constitution of Malawi which makes it mandatory that 3 days before the closure of the campaign period, the cabinet has to be dissolved.
Umgeme Nkalilan is the spokesman for Malawian President Peter Mutharika. Guinea passes a new law requiring gender parity for electoral candidates. At least 600 refugees residing in Kenya's Dadaab refugee camp are willing to voluntarily return to their countries of origin. And Togo takes steps to boost women participation in the coming June 30th local government election.
There is no problem of discrimination in Togo between women and men, and so I don't think that are the problems which we are fighting. Those things are distractions.
Jean-Pierre Fabre is the leader of Togo's main opposition, National Alliance for Change Party. And a new survey finds most South Sudanese are hopeful that peace is possible in their country. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Malawi President Peter Mutharika has dissolved his 20-member cabinet just 5 days before the country's May 21st general election, where Mr. Mutharika is seeking a second term. A presidential statement said President Mutharika will assume all ministerial powers, functions, and responsibilities until a new cabinet is appointed. The dissolution comes just 5 days before Malawians go to the polls to elect a new president. So, why did President Mutharika find it necessary to dissolve the cabinet? Presidential spokesman Umgeme Nkalilane says the dissolution is in line with Malawi's constitution, which stipulates that the president can dissolve cabinet at any time of his choosing.
As you know, Malawi is a constitutional democracy, and we have a section in the Constitution of Malawi, Section 95, Article 2, which makes it mandatory that 3 days before the closure of the campaign period, the cabinet of the government has to be dissolved. So what the president has done is simply to follow what the constitutional requirement demands.
That's good, but I guess the question I have, and maybe the question that some Malawians will have, is the country is voting next Tuesday, so why did the president decide to do it now to change the cabinet?
Well, the voting, you're correct, is happening next Tuesday. The requirement is that the dissolution should be done before the closure of the campaign period. So campaign closes this coming Sunday. So we have 3 days to Sunday. So the day for the dissolution of parliament stands today.
Did the president do this for electoral gains?
Not at all. It's just a constitutional requirement. If he had not done so, he'd be breaching the constitution, and then one would take him to court for that. It's merely a constitutional requirement.
Back to the campaign. The campaign is in high gear now. How is the president's campaign doing? He's seeking re-election. How do you think he has managed the country for the past 4 years? Because he's seeking re-election. Why do you think the people should re-elect him?
No, we're confident of emerging victorious come Tuesday. Our confidence stems with the fact that the president has performed exceptionally very well, and several research that was commissioned by the party on the ground has indicated that a lot of Malawians are expressing confidence at the rate of delivery the president has shown for the past 5 years. Arguably, he has delivered more than any other president in this country, both post and pre-colonial times. The president came in at a very difficult time. He came in at the time when the international support was at its lowest. Remember, the international community stopped funding the national budget due to the problem that we had with the cash debt. So very difficult time, but within that time, the president has managed to stabilize the economy. Inflation has gone down. The GDP of the country has improved. And that is something that Malawians are appreciating, and we're very confident that it will translate into a vote come Tuesday.
I spoke yesterday to the Southern Africa director of Amnesty International. The Amnesty put out a statement, in fact, appealing to the next government following the election to come up with a decisive policy on how to deal with the treatment of people with albinism in Malawi. How do you think your government has done in that area?
Yeah, it's been a challenge. And this challenge, if you've been following about current affairs in Southern Africa, has not been only an issue in Malawi. It has been an issue in several countries in Southern Africa. Mozambique, Tanzania have been grappling with the same problem. The current government of His Excellency the President has been trying within its means.
Mgami Kalilani is spokesman for Malawian President Peter Mutharika. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lilongwe. The leader of Togo's 14-party opposition coalition says the political problem in Togo is not whether there are more or less women politicians, but rather the lack of democracy and the rule of law. Jean-Pierre Fabre, leader of the main opposition National Alliance for Change Party, says there is need for national laws compelling parents to educate their girl or boy children. This comes after President Fortuna Simbo's government announced that women candidates in the coming June 30 local election, government election, should pay CFA 10,000, half the amount that male candidates should pay. Jean-Pierre Fabre says, unlike last year when the opposition boycotted the election, this time around, his party has been recruiting candidates to contest the June 30 local government election.
You know, the conditions are bad, but we, the senators, are elected by people who will be elected in the local election. And so if you don't take part of the local election, you will not have senators. And is to not allow the ruling party to take all the senators. And we want to be part of these elections to have senators elected.
Mr. Fabre, during the protest, the opposition were calling on President Fortuna Simbe to either step down or make some election reforms. What has changed? Did the president make any good reforms that has allowed you to be part of the election?
No. I want to be very clear. The reforms they have done last week are not what we wanted. But we continue to fight to have better conditions because they don't want to organize free and fair elections so that they can move. And I know there are some reasons that make international community to close their eyes on what is going on in Togo. But it is our Togolese problem, and we have to fight to liberate our country.
President Fortuna Simbe and the current parliament, they decided that women who are participating in the local elections on June 30th will pay a fee of CFA 10,000. This is half the amount set for male candidates. First of all, will your party have women candidates to take part in the election?
Yeah, but that is not the problem in Togo. There is no problem of discrimination in Togo between women and men. And so I don't think that are the problems which we are fighting. Those things are distractions. It's democracy, rule of law, and other things.
But some people said we need more women participation.
I don't know that kind of problem in my family. Those problems are not the problem in Togo. Before saying those things, you have to oblige people to send their daughters. They have to go to school. It will have laws to oblige families to send their children to school. Those kind of laws don't exist in Togo.
What has become of the negotiations between the government and the opposition that was being mediated by ECOWAS?
ECOWAS has done bad things here. ECOWAS have a roadmap, and the roadmap will not respect it. And ECOWAS says nothing. That's why we didn't go to an election.
Who did not respect the roadmap? The government?
The government, but ECOWAS didn't say anything. The roadmap says we have to make the reforms before the election. And the Togolese government refused to make the reforms. And ECOWAS said nothing. ECOWAS has failed in Togo.
Mr. Fabre, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Okay, thank you very much.
Jean-Pierre Fabre is the leader of Togo's main opposition, the National Alliance for Change Party. You are speaking with me from the capital, Lomé. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Mbote in Washington. Today is Thursday, May 16th. Daybreak Africa time, 15 minutes past the hour. Guinea has passed a new law requiring gender parity on electoral candidate lists for the next legislative election, following in the path of other countries in the West African region, such as Guinea-Bissau and Senegal. Vincent Faucher, a researcher for the French National Center for Scientific Research, says the move is welcome, but Faucher cautions that such a move is likely to lead to gender washing.
This has become a very standard feature of the standard democracy in West Africa these days. Each party basically have to include 50% women in their list of candidates. Of course, it's on the list, so it doesn't mean that your actual electees are 50-50. And usually it remains that men in majority, men tend to be elected more because they usually are the first on the list, not the second one, for instance, if there are two seats. Or they will be allocated to run in more solid constituency and so on. So it's not going to end the bias. The problem, of course, is that there is a tendency to what people call gender washing. You take gender laws, you know, in all sorts of sectors, whether it be politics or feminine genital mutilation or wedding laws, laws that are seen as favorable to women, as an easy step to appease international opinion and Western donors who are very sensitive to those issues. And all the while, you are not so democratic or not in terms of procedures in other more strategic sectors, which I think is what is happening in Guinea with the move to reform the constitution and so on.
Can you expand on that when you say it's a welcome law, but in the context of the move to rework the constitution?
President Condé is in power as a result of the 2010 transition constitution and got him elected in 2011. He has done two mandates, which is theoretically the limit set by the 2010 constitution. And there is a growing move by his supporters to push for a new constitution or a change in the constitution. It's not quite clear yet what form this will take, and to have him run for a third term.
What is allowing Guinea, for example, to keep on changing the laws, though, to not stick to the laws?
Partisans of President Condé are using the argument that legitimacy lies essentially with the people. And so if the people decide, if there's a referendum, for instance, then no constitutional limit can actually hold. It's just for the people's choice. But I think this is a wrong understanding of what liberal democracy is about. Liberal democracy is not just the vote of the people and that's all. It's the vote of the people with rules, with legal principles, with constitutional principles, fundamental constitutional principles. That's the two things together. It's not just the will of the people.
Do you think it speaks to the fact that the judiciary in Guinea has a lot less power than maybe it should, or has a lot less power than maybe other judiciaries in liberal democracies?
Well, I mean, the judiciary in Guinea, there is a constitutional court, and actually the president of the constitutional court was removed by his colleagues, probably at the instigation of the executive power.
That was Vincent Faucher, a researcher for the French National Center for Scientific Research. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Paris. At least 600 refugees residing in Kenya's Dadaab refugee camp say they are willing to voluntarily go back to their countries of origin. This comes after the Kenyan government announced the closure of the Dadaab refugee camp following security threats by the militant group Al-Shabaab. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, the United Nations High Commission for Refugees said some refugees who will not like to relocate will be hosted at the Kakuma refugee camp.
Last week, refugees who have been given temporary shelter in Nairobi held protests daily outside the UNHCR offices in Nairobi before the police lobbed tear gas canisters to disperse them, a move that led to the UNHCR addressing the media. Speaking in Nairobi, United Nations High Commission for Refugees representative Fadi Abdallah said that they are working closely with the government as they plan to register refugees who are not registered and that some of the refugees will be relocated to Kakuma refugee camp.
affected them as well.
Dadaab refugee camp is host to more than 200,000 refugees, and its closure will be a blow to the international community. Robert Hart, the head of unit in charge of UNHCR risk management, said that they will not take care of the refugees who are having emergency shelter and receiving financial assistance, since most of them do not want to leave after their staying documents have expired.
Small number of persons who have refused to leave. Now, we cannot provide assistance to those persons after the closure of the facility was announced.
Last week, the refugees residing in Nairobi camped outside the UNHCR offices protesting negligence of their needs by the UN body, a move that saw the police lob tear gas to disperse the group. Mr. Robert says not all of the refugees' problems can be solved by UNHCR.
The toll-free helpline, if people call up and say, I wish to make a complaint, I wish to make an allegation, then they can make that. And it will go through to our Inspector General's office, which is an independent body, to ensure that all allegations that rise to a level of seriousness are investigated professionally.
The three-decade-old Dadaab camp in eastern Kenya, which shelters mostly Somalis, will be closed by the end of August under the Kenyan plan. The United Nations Refugee Agency document dated February 28, 2019, said that the Kenyan government had sent a note informing it of plans to close the Dadaab camp within a six-month period, citing insecurity from the militia group Al-Shabaab. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
The United Nations mission in South Sudan says a perception survey it carried out across the country found there is hope among South Sudanese that peace is possible. Army's Chief David Shearer is calling on the parties to the peace agreement to use the six-month extension to achieve sustainable peace. Dimo Silva Aurelio reports from Juba.
The results of the perception survey released indicate most South Sudanese think the security situation in the country has improved, and they believe that peace can prevail across the country if the parties continue to implement the security arrangements. The report is based on findings of face-to-face interviews with more than 2,000 people conducted over the past 5 months in towns, villages and UN-run protection of civilian sites in 10 areas where ANMIS has bases. Sierra says a report carried by a Jordan-based consulting firm indicates that out of the more than 2,000 people interviewed, 80% say the security situation has greatly improved compared to a year ago after the revitalized peace agreement was signed.
Only 5% thought it was worse or much worse. So pretty overwhelming, 80% feeling it was either better or much better than it was 1 year ago.
Sierra says the survey also focused on the prospects for peace by asking people how likely it was that there would be lasting peace in a year's time.
89% said it was either very or somewhat likely that there will be durable peace this year. So nearly 90% are optimistic, effectively, that there will be peace in the coming 1 year.
The survey also found that 79% of the people interviewed have lost at least one family member or have family members who were displaced during the nearly 6 years of conflict because the government has failed to protect them. Sierra says the survey shows that overall, the South Sudanese people are optimistic about the future.
Too often the news that we hear in South Sudan is negative, and that's not surprising given what the country has gone through. But I think that the survey offers some hope that we are on the right path, or more particularly that people believe we should be on the right path.
But one Juba resident who did not want to be mentioned for fear of government reprisal says he doesn't see any security improvement in the town, especially in recent days.
As a civilian, I've been moving around and I see so many soldiers in every location. So the security situation is not all that okay. That is what I see, because if you see many people, less the soldiers moving in uniform, is something that is bad for civilians like us. At least the people should be informed before these soldiers go to check the civilian houses where they say they are checking guns. So currently, the security situation is not fine.
The ANMIS chief says such surveys should be able to motivate the parties to work towards achieving sustainable peace for the South Sudanese people by cultivating the political will that is needed to fully implement the peace agreement. asked to comment on a social media campaign by a group that calls itself the Red Card Movement, which is urging youth to turn out in large numbers on Thursday to protest against the Kiir administration. Sierra has this to say.
People have the right to attend rallies, as they do in any other country, so long as they undertake that in a peaceful and respectful way. So people have a right to express their opinion. And from the government's point of view, they have to ensure that the demonstration is carried out in a safe and orderly way.
South Sudanese government officials today deployed more military and National Security Service personnel around strategic locations around Juba, as they have for the past several days. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
Scientists of University College London are developing new technology to help doctors detect deadly bowel cancer and polyps in their earlier stages and ensure the best chances of a patient's recovery. Zlatika Hoke has details.
Bowel cancer is the world's third most common type of cancer, and the sooner it is detected, the better chance a patient has to recover. But a doctor performing a diagnostic colonoscopy does not always see everything shown on the screen, and smaller details often go undetected.
We miss about 1 in 5 polyps during colonoscopy. And for the second biggest cause of cancer-related death in the UK, that's a big deal.
Scientists say artificial intelligence can see the entire image. It never looks the wrong way, and it never gets distracted.
As the live video is being streamed, our system takes in that image frame by frame, processes it with what we call an artificial neural network, and tries to identify where those polyps are by looking at things like the patterns of in the images, the different coloration of the tissue.
That data is too big and too detailed to be sent via the internet. So instead, Auden Vision uses the communication between the Earth and satellites millions of miles away, where the AI is stored in a cloud and transmits the information back in real time to the doctors who are making a diagnosis. The development of the new technology is in early stages. If it proves successful, the cloud will be accessible to clinics and hospitals even in rural areas, ensuring that every patient gets the earliest and most accurate diagnosis.
AI is essentially putting us at the point where we can ensure quality of service. So we're in essence democratizing healthcare, because we can make sure that you get the best expert type of diagnostic function everywhere throughout our hospitals.
Auden Vision scientists hope their breakthrough program will save thousands of lives and help patients avoid radical procedures. Bowel cancer survivors hope the new diagnostic technology will be available soon.
Hopefully, this piece of software will be introduced, and so that my family can get reassurance quicker that everything is all right or not with my own health.
Auden Vision is planning a clinical pilot study in the next 12 months and expects early versions of the technology to roll out in the next 2 years. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
And that's it for this Thursday, May 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Greg Burns, I'm James Botta in Washington, wishing everyone in Africa a very, very good day.
Sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in, you will be glad you did. I guarantee it.